Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer. Today, joined once again by Makone Maja. Makone, thank you so much for being on the show 2 days in a row. It's very nice to have you back here.
I'm always happy to be here with you, Nick, even on a Friday afternoon, and even when it's just the two of us. Well, with
Indeed,
everyone
we
watching
are.
as well.
Yes, we are a bit short-staffed today, as most of our colleagues are at a conference or something. So we shall do our best to entertain and enlighten as we do. Just a warning for anyone up in Gauteng over on Monday. It is going to be really, really cold, apparently. So I'm not looking forward to that. Anyway, let's get into the news of today. And the first story we're going to talk a little bit about is Panyaza Lesufi, the premier of Gauteng. At least in his rhetoric, softening a little bit on his stance towards negotiation with the DA. So the DA and ANC could not agree on how many MEC positions the DA would get in the Gauteng government. The DA was looking at sort of four or five positions out of 11, I think it is. The ANC was only willing to offer them two or three, and then a number of positions in portfolio committees in the legislature, but that's, not much. And as a result, the DA basically refused to sign any deal. There was a very hostile press conference where the ANC essentially called them a bunch of crybabies who were expecting too much and being arrogant. And so the DA walked away from the deal and said that they would not be dictated to. Well, it looks like Panyaza Lesufi is maybe a little bit backpedaling on this. So Refiloe Ntheke was the DA person elected as deputy speaker in the Gauteng legislature, and the DA says that she will resign on Thursday to when they actually take up their seats in the opposition benches. And Panyaza Lesufi is now suddenly saying, "Well, maybe let's not be hasty here, people. Come, let's see if we can talk some more." He said, quote, "We're going to persuade the DA to remain. I honestly believe we can still find common ground. The withdrawal of the deputy speaker is unfortunate and regrettable, but it's something that can be reversed. There was no need for them to abruptly withdraw the deputy speaker while we were going to discuss this matter. It's unfortunate and regrettable, but we'll persuade them. The door is open. We can't close that door." He then went on to say, "We are ready to provide them with six portfolio committees. We emphasize we are ready to give three MEC positions. It was unfortunate we had to establish a government. We've been keeping the people of Gauteng waiting, and we were the only province without an executive council. We were at the doorstep of catastrophe where the budget was not approved and many institutions could not be paid. This was going to cause problems. That's the reasons I had to establish a government, but the door is not closed." The DA has also said something along the lines of they're still willing to talk if the ANC softens some of its positions. So it's possible something could still come together here. And I suspect Lesufi has been under some pressure from Luthuli House, perhaps to, maybe make this thing work. But it's a little bit of an awkward position for the people that Lesufi did include from other parties in his provincial government. So, along with the ANC, who dominate most of the positions in the Gauteng provincial government, Lesufi also appointed people from the Patriotic Alliance, the IFP, and Rise Mzansi. Presumably, those are the three seats they were willing to give to the DA. But if he goes back into coalition with the DA and the DA gets, I don't know, four seats, is he going to chuck those people out? I think that's very likely. And they're going to feel very uncomfortable, I think, being used for just a short amount of time. But Makone, why do you think Lesufi is sounding a more conciliatory tone here? Do you think it's because he's just realized that he's going to need control of the legislature? Do you think it's because he's not able to make a deal with the EFF because Luthuli House has told him no? What's your thoughts on what's going on here?
I lean more towards the former, Nick. I think he's realized that he's basically castrated his own government. He will basically not be able to do anything because he does not have a majority. And like you pointed out, what happens to the positions that he's already filled with MPs that would have otherwise gone to the DA? Are they just now placeholders and the whole country's watching them, knowing that they're just waiting for when the deal is finally struck with the DA and five of them have to vacate their positions? I mean, this is the sort of instability that I think the ANC wanted to overcome or prevent to begin with. And Also, how many times was Banyaza Lesufi instructed by Luthuli House to stand down on the announcement of the Gauteng legislature, of his appointments into those positions? That tells you something. It's almost as though the DA's basically called his bluff and the emperor's been caught with no pants on. So what exactly was he going to announce all those times? The media scheduled time and time again slots for him to come and inform us of who exactly will the Gauteng legislature be constituted by. I'm not surprised to see the sort of behavior by him in Gauteng. I mean, if you look at how the KZN legislature, right, which is worth contrasting to, how that was quickly formed between the IFP, the DA, and the ANC, tells you a lot more about who's been arrogant throughout these negotiation processes. And while the media has been rushing to call the DA the arrogant party who are so entitled to positions, seems to me that it may actually be the ANC, because as Helen Ziller remarked on an interview on Biz News, with the KZN legislature, the IFP basically dealt every party sufficient positions that everyone was due, took their own, and that was it, done and dusted in a day or two. And yet here we're now going on yet another week of uncertainty and instability within the Gauteng legislature because of people like Banyaza Lesufi being greedy, overplaying his hand and being too clever by half. But his bluff has essentially been called out because the DA walked away.
Right, you know, he talks about the budget not being approved. Well, you know, you still have to pass budgets through the legislature. So you can draw up one now with your cabinet and then the DA can just say, hey, we're not going to vote for it. And then you're going to go to what, the EFF or MK and say, please vote for my budget. And they'll say, oh, buddy, we're going to make some changes there. So not really a great position. And I think very quickly he is going to realize that, you know, without some sort of arrangement, whether it is a supply and confidence one, whether it is some kind of power sharing agreement, which I think is what the DA is angling for, there's just not going to be anything that he's able to get done. And of course, he's going to be vulnerable to votes of no confidence. Now, I don't know actually if the EFF would go along with that, because Lesufi is definitely one of the closest politicians in the country, in the ANC at least, to the EFF. So they probably don't want to undermine him too much. But you never really know. I think, once again, you know, it's already gotten tired of saying this, but we are definitely in new ground. Any final thoughts on this one, McCorney, before we move on?
I'm also quite surprised by the resistance towards forming a government with the EFF. I mean, they've had a chance to govern in Ekurhuleni. I would think they'd give it another go in Gauteng, especially because, like you pointed out, Lesufi and members of the EFF seem to have a very collegial relationship, an amicable one. They seem to support each other. And yet that's not forming into any material governance structure in the country's economic hub, where I would think the EFF would be only too eager to step in and stake their claim. And yet their relationship, as cozy as it is, has not really materialized into any beneficial material benefit for the EFF. And so I'm inclined to think that now that those ties are not constituted in an actual political relationship, the EFF doesn't owe him anything anymore.
Right. They're very much hoping that the DA and the ANC will fight with each other so that they can sort of sweep back in and say, did you miss us? It's also, of course, worse for the EFF, because I think about somewhere around a third of all EFF votes in the country come from Gauteng. So it's a very important province for them. And being able to get their hands on provincial government, I think it would be a big score for them. Whereas for the ANC, Gauteng is continuously being a less and less important province as their vote has dwindled there. Anyway, let's move on to our next story. And we sort of mentioned this yesterday, actually, in the discussion that you and I had, McCorney. It's been 100 days without load shedding in Eskom. This is apparently the longest period we haven't had load shedding since September 8th to December 11th, 2020. So that's pretty good going. And I must say that I was very wrong to suggest that the load shedding might possibly resume after the election. I was being perhaps a bit too cynical. There does appear to have been some genuine improvement at Eskom. The energy availability factor at Eskom, which has been kind of bumping around between 50 and 60 in the last year, has managed to climb up to above 60 for the past couple of months, which is some actual improvement. However, I do think in a lot of ways that Eskom has been saved by two things. One, they haven't had any big catastrophes like the big, I think it was at Madupi Power Plant, I think it was, or I can't remember. It was either Kusile or Madupi, one of the new ones. There was a chimney that collapsed. That was a big problem for them. And also the fact that so many people have gone off-grid or found alternative solutions or put solar on their houses, whatever, which has reduced some of the draw on the grid, which is definitely helping them. The other thing that's mentioned here by Eskom is they say that they've been running their open cycle gas turbines far less than usual, which is very good because those things are ridiculously expensive. And Eskom believes that if it manages to keep not using them, it will actually be able to maybe possibly, hopefully one day turn a little bit of a profit in the not too distant future. Now, optimistic, we know we haven't even had a year load shedding yet. There's still many things that could go wrong. I don't know, but we could have another boiler or something that blows up and then we might be back in load shedding. But Mokoena, what do you make of this? I mean, I think Ramaphosa can probably at least claim some credit here. You know, do you think it's just down to him? Or what do you make of why we've had less load shedding?
I think those private sector, public sector crisis committees are finally paying off. I think a lot of it goes to that and also a change in leadership at Eskom. I'm also quite impressed, Nick, with the 100 days worth of load shedding. I think we have very few opportunities in this country to celebrate governance, and this is certainly a win for governance, good governance at Eskom.
From a low bar.
The bars have been low for a while, but I will take a 60 above 60 EAF anytime over when we were just hovering around the early 50s. That is a significant improvement. So well done to the Eskom team. I would one day like to see the Minister of Electricity position go away entirely. I think there's just too many conflicting mandates between the Minister of Electricity and the Minister of Public Enterprises and the Minister of Minerals and Energy. I think those three different ministries can hopefully one day be expunged into one, because yeah, conflicting mandates just mean that more bureaucracy obviously just clogs up opportunities for service delivery. But back to Eskom, you've also seen Bank of America come out and say, well, South Africa could turn a 2% GDP growth in the medium term. Investec pegs that only in the years 2027 and 2028. So we'll only really begin to enjoy and reap the benefits of sustained electricity in much longer terms, I would think. I would, at least according to Investec's baseline projections, but very good nonetheless. I mean, we've been struggling to even get it, our GDP growth forecasts up to 1%. So to double that is certainly very encouraging. Not where it needs to be, I appreciate that, but at least we're making a turn in the right direction, dealing with one of the biggest constraints to economic growth in this country, and that certainly has been Eskom for a long time.
Yeah, and I think I just want to highlight exactly how much more improvement is needed, because if the economy actually starts growing, I think, I mean, 2% is very, very modest. It's much better, as you say, than what we've had in the past couple of years, but still very, very low. So if the economy starts growing again, we're going to use more electricity. And once again, we're going to be back in the same place. So it's very important that these improvements continue at a steady pace, because if they don't, we're going to find ourselves maybe in 2025, 2026, in just the same place we were in 2023. That's obviously not going to be very good for the country. So let's hope that the improvements we're seeing are not just short-term little gains, but actual genuine improvements in efficiency. There does seem to be some improvement in how they're running the coal power plants, which I think is a key thing here. And with any luck, some of the new electricity generation projects will come online by then. But we're still not even close to out of the woods yet. And Eskom says as much themselves. They've kind of said, yeah, no, load shedding is still very much a possibility. We haven't had it yet, but touch wood. Let's hope this continues.
I think they indicated that about 800 megawatts of a park in Kusile has come online as well. So you are seeing some of those investments we made years ago only coming in now, and we're starting to reap the benefits of that, which again is very good and should be encouraged. But yeah, no, 2% is not where the country needs to be to sustain the growing population levels, and also, like you pointed out, energy economic growth begets bigger energy capacity. So the government should really be looking towards sustaining that, but also increasing our capacity for sustainable, cheap, and efficient energy provision.
If we want to make any progress in properly ending our major unemployment and our poverty here in South Africa, we need to have growth of over 5%, preferably closer to 7%. And until we get that, we're just going to continue sort of bumping along in this not very sustainable or comfortable position that we're currently in. Anyway, let's move on to our next story. And this is, there's not that much news to be said here, except we can kind of, I think, analyze the politics of it yet, which is that Basic Education Minister Siviwe Gorube from the DA has said that she wants to prioritize eradicating pit toilets in schools, saying that this was something close to her heart. She said, however, that it's not just up to education, and she's asked one of her DA colleagues, Dean McPherson, who runs the Public Infrastructure and Works Ministry, to assist her as much as he can in eradicating pit toilets. Now, I think the ANC has promised in pretty much every single manifesto since 1994 that it was going to eradicate pit toilets. So it's going to be very interesting to see whether there's any movement on this one. Guarube says that there's about 4,000 pit toilets in schools left in the country, which is obviously, by itself, it's a horrible issue, because every now and again, a child falls into one of these things and dies, which is just one of the most awful things you can imagine. But it's sort of a bit of a stand-in, I think, for the general state of infrastructure and decay across so many of South Africa's schools, is that there's still kids, basically learning in dilapidated buildings or sometimes even outside, which is not great if you're trying to escape poverty through education. And it's been quite interesting to watch the sort of the media reaction to this stuff. And I'm going to add to this a separate issue, which is that if you look at the ages of various ministers, I think the oldest minister in cabinet is Patricia de Lille from the Good Party, who's about 73, I think I'm correct in saying. The ANC ministers all tend to be above 60. There's a couple below 60, but most of them are above. And then the DA ones are by far the youngest. Siviwe, I think, is the youngest minister in cabinet, somewhere in her 30s. And the oldest DA minister is, I think, Dion George at 58 years old. So it's quite interesting in a sort of in a kind of political sense to look at this new cabinet, and you've already got the two parties, I think, trying to kind of play politics against each other. The ANC saying, no one's allowed to do anything unless we all agree together as a cabinet. And the DA is kind of just trying to run with what it can and say, no, we're going to fix pit toilets, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do this. We're going to extend the visa, and they're publicizing it all on their social media. And I think that perspective of them being energetic that they're trying to project is going to be helped by the fact that a lot of their ministers are quite a lot younger than the ANC's. What do you make of this, Makone?
I should add, Nick, that the youngest MP is, of course, our very own Mlondi Mdluli, also a member of the DA. And he's actually had an article published about him.
He's not the youngest MP. He's the third youngest, I think.
Oh, at 26. That's surprising.
Yeah, the Patriotic Alliance, I think, has one in their early 20s. I think I'm correct in saying, or two in their early 20s.
That oh wow. The article I read this morning gave me the impression that Mlondi was the youngest, despite
I
that
could be
bit of fact.
wrong,
Okay,
but
fair.
Mlondi, if you're watching, please tell us.
Please clarify. We celebrate Mlondi's appointment nonetheless, but I've been actually keeping up with the DAMP's tour of media interviews over the last couple of days since they're swearing in. I, of course, watched Minister of Education Gwarube's interviews. I specifically watched her on, I think it was SABC News or was it Newsroom Africa? And I've noticed that the journalists are setting them up with a bunch of booby traps, which they're navigating with such tact and integrity. And it's been very inspirational and admiring to watch, not just how they're conducting themselves, but also the reception of a lot of audiences to the DA ministers, specifically Minister Gwarube. I think everyone gets a sense that she's in trouble, especially because even before her swearing in, SATU condemned her appointment and showed hostility toward working with her, which in her response, she indicated how disappointed she was with that, and that her door remains open to, of course, have conversations with all stakeholders because, yes, teachers' rights are important, but at the center of education should be children. And to see her just want to hit the ground running on specifically on the issue of pit toilets, which we've covered so much on the show, Nick. You'll remember a few weeks ago, I think, a municipality was being brought to court again upon its failure to meet its own deadlines to eradicate pit latrines in schools where those municipalities were situated. This was a municipality failing to meet its own deadline, and it was not the first time that it was appearing at court over such a failure. So to see her being forceful about that and going in to eradicate that, I think has also made and united people in her favor, but also certainly in the DA's favor. I think the DA has a very unique opportunity to bridge a lot of gaps, whether they are class gaps or racial gaps in the country, with a lot of these ministerial appointments that people will finally not have a leg to stand on by saying that the DA is a party that works for white people or works for a certain class of people. Economic class of people, when they see Minister Gwarube go and attack issues that are faced by the poorest of the poor in this country. So I think the DA honestly has a very unique position to turn the sentiment, especially some of the superficial racially antagonistic sentiment, on its head when ministers like her, Minister like Leon Schreiber, going forceful at issues that affect some of the poorest classes in this country. So that's honestly been very encouraging to observe.
So I just want to respond to something that one of our viewers, Andre, said here. He said, to talk about age qualifications has no meaning. I look to the value that people add. And to be frank, I completely agree with that. I don't believe in sort of age or youth politics at all. I think it's really silly often. But that being said, in terms of perceptions, I think it's very useful, politically speaking, for the DA. You know, just because you're young doesn't mean you're going to do a good job. In fact, often it means you're going to do a bad job. But if the government is seen as being lethargic and you are younger and you come in and you immediately start pushing out media and talking about things you're going to do, you're going to definitely help yourself in the perceptions game. And I think what we're seeing here is, I think, why the DA took this deal. You know, I've been quite critical of it. I think that they didn't get enough. I thought that going into a full coalition was not a great idea to begin with. But if you are going to go into one, I think the thing you have to do is try, and exactly as you say, McCorney, like go out in the media and just tackle issues in a very public way, in a very big way, and just try and do what you can with what you have. Now, simply saying we're going to eradicate pit toilets, as I said, you know, that's been promised a million times over. And in many ways, it's quite a good issue to pick up on first because it's not an ideological issue. The ANC is not going to be able to say, you know, if you wanted to deregulate the labor market, for example, the ANC would say, no, you're hurting the workers. This is evil capitalist nonsense. But get rid of pit toilets? Well, the ANC can't really argue with you on that one. So I think the DA will have a very strong case to be made if it's not able to get the job done it will point to the ANC and say, you see, they're obstructing us. We tried to do something as simple as get rid of pit toilets, and now look what's happened. Of course, it would be a lot more in their favor if they could actually fix the issue, because I think South Africans are desperate for their government to have a win, which is why we get so excited whenever the country does well. So we'll have to see whether they can actually accomplish what they set out to do here. Any more thoughts on this one before we move on?
I would like to respond as well to Andre. And I think there is a point where age does matter. Like in the American election, we're seeing people that are too old
to run. Don't be in your 80s.
Exactly. Don't be in your 80s and maybe not in your early 20s as well. But I also agree that it's the substance of the person who's governing that matters. But we can't ignore that a lot of our politics are governed by people who believe and advocate for representation. Now, I'm not one of those people. I don't think immutable characteristics should determine your likability or favorability among constituencies. But I can't ignore the fact that people do. People care that there are leaders who represent them, whether it's by age or by sex or by race in government. People care that people who look like them are reflected in their government. And that's a win for the DA, for the people who do care about those things. So whilst I'm not necessarily one of those people, I think it's a very limiting belief system, this representation thing. But I cannot ignore that they are a large group of people to whom it is an issue.
All right, let's move on to our next story. And I think in the last couple of minutes here, we'll just mention quickly the results of the British election. So I think it will come as no surprise to anyone who's paid any attention to the British election campaign that Labour won, and they didn't just win, they won, to quote Donald Trump, bigly. And that was pretty much expected, but they've won a lot of seats in a quite interesting way. So the British, of course, have this system of first past the post, where you vote for an MP in a constituency. And so as long as you get the most votes in your constituency, it doesn't matter whether you win with 20% of the vote or 56% of the vote, you get the seat in parliament, which means that the total percentage of the votes in the country is often quite different from the percentage of seats you get in parliament. And we're really seeing that in this election in particular. This has always, I think, been the case in the UK, but it's particularly significant in this one. So Labour picked up, I think there's 650 seats. They picked up 211, going all the way up to 412. The Conservative Party, who have ruled the country for 14 years, had an absolutely terrible night. They lost 250 seats, and they saw their vote share decrease by about 20%. They were in the sort of mid-40s when they last faced the election in 2019. But what's quite interesting here is that Labour only saw a marginal increase in its vote share, going up by about 1.6% of the vote. The Liberal Democrats, who have got the third most seats in Parliament, it's 71 now after this election, themselves also having a very good night, only got about a half a percentage vote increase in their showing. Some parties that did quite well, but didn't get that many seats. The Reform Party, who only got about four seats, but about 14% of the vote, seeing themselves shoot up quite significantly from the last election, and just slightly topping their predecessor's best performance, which was UKIP in 2015, where they got about 12% of the vote. The Green Party got four seats. They managed about 7% of the vote. That's a big bit of growth for them. And the Scottish National Party, who advocate for independence for Scotland, had a bad night, losing about a third of their vote. And also most of their seats, going from, I think it was about 40-something seats to 9, which is not terribly good at all. What this suggests, though, to me, McCorney, is that Labour, while they may have won this big majority in Parliament, it's on a bit of shaky ground that they're going to have to consolidate. They only won about a third of the vote. So the number of seats they have could very easily be overturned in the next election. With, you know, relatively small swing of the vote share, if the Conservatives or Reform or someone, you know, dropped out and they managed to, the right managed to rebuild itself, you may very, very quickly see a complete reversal of these electoral gains. if they're not careful. But yeah, it looks very much like it is an interesting inflection point in British politics. The Conservative Party is going to have to go through a major period of fixing itself, recovering itself, and Labour is going to have to try and consolidate its vote share. And I think the Reform Party will be both pleased and disappointed. They got four seats, which is the best they've ever done, and their leader, Nigel Farage, is now in Parliament for the first time. But they didn't manage to come close to overtaking the Tories in vote share, the Conservatives in vote share, which is one of their stated aims. And I think they will also, in the end, perhaps be a little bit disappointed by the selection result. Now, before you answer, Makwane, just we will have a special on this on Monday where myself, Herman Pretorius, and a guy called Ed from the UK are going to chat about this much more in depth. But Makwane, what's your takes just seeing these results come out?
Just on the face of it, I'm not very apt in British politics, but it looks like backlash voting on the part of Conservative voters just choosing not to vote or vote for the Labour Party, because it seems that the Conservative Party has governed or administered Liberal policies over their last 14 years, certainly over the last 5 years, going hard on things like net zero, not doing enough to tighten immigration, widening their debt burden, and also just seeing a surge in energy prices, which has been crushing to the middle class Britain citizens. So a lot of it seems like backlash voting, and I think it's certainly encouraged by the voting system that they have, the first past the post, where a minority government is able to take the entire parliament and govern in that way. So I think what also places the Labour Party, which you've aptly observed, what puts them in the conundrum is that people are voting against Liberal policies, and yet they voted in favor of the Labour Party, which should in theory be the ones implementing or going forth and pursuing those Liberal policies that people have voted against. So I think that's what places them in a conundrum, is that whilst people have voted whilst they've taken the vote share away from the Conservative Party, they still have to go and implement their own Liberal policies, which people have been opposing for the last 5 years. I think that certainly puts them between a rock and a hard place, because how do they stamp their own policies that people have essentially revolted against?
So one thing I would say is I would disagree a little bit on your use of the word Liberal there. I think that's really only in the American sense that their policies could be called liberal. I think, to my mind, sort of progressive or left-wing are more accurately descriptive of Labour's direction. But I agree definitely with your point there that, you know, Labour only won the election in part because their leader, Keir Starmer, very, very deliberately pushed the party away from the far-left position it was in under Jeremy Corbyn back in 2019 when the party suffered this big defeat. And by moving to the centre, he's managed now to get at least some Conservative voters off the bench, or at least to make some Conservative voters say, we're not just going to put the Conservatives in power again, because actually we can probably live with Labour, and we're so angry with them, we're going to vote for the Reform Party. I think it's part of what happened. Also, another thing we haven't mentioned here, which I think we'll go more into on Monday, is just that a lot of British people got really sick of all the infighting in the Conservative Party, which was horrific. I mean, we saw it with chucking out Boris Johnson, replacing him with Liz Truss for, you know, 40 days or something, hours. Chucking her out, you know, 3 hours shorter than the lettuce, and then replacing her with Rishi Sunak, who is a bit of a tragic figure because he sort of got left with like everyone else's rubbish in his backyard, and then he had absolutely no time to clear it all, and he just got completely crushed in the selection. I mean, his announcement of the selection was one of the saddest things I think I've ever seen in politics, standing in the rain while angry protesters chant outside, no umbrella or anything, just sort of saying, oh, we're going to have an election in 6 weeks in which I'm going to lose.
The imagery of that election announcement mirrors so closely to the Conservative Party election outcome. It is uncanny.
Yeah, it was such a dark port for how things are going to go for them. I think it's very good to change governments every now and again, because I think any party, when it's in power for too long, gets very dysfunctional, and I think that's been proven by the UK. So this will probably actually, in the long run, I think, be good for the Conservatives now that they're able to go back into the opposition benches, rethink their positions, and sort of figure out where to go next. As you say, you know, we can see in the vote shares that there's a very big sort of right to center right block in the UK still that very easily could swing behind them if they can reorient themselves in the right way. And Labour is going to have a very difficult time now resisting the impulse of that big majority to go and just do whatever they want and go back on their sort of centrist campaign here, which, as you said, I think completely rightly, is not going to endear them, I think, to a lot of voters, particularly swing voters in the UK. Anyway, much to talk about, much to see. But I think despite the fact there's only two of us, we've actually managed to go long. So thank you very much, McCoy, for being on the show today. It was really appreciated. And we will see you all next week. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone. Cheers for now.